This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the chief test pilot of Martin Aircraft Company about the Martin Jetpack. In the news, we look at the major engine failure of Air France Flight 66, the Emirates A380 that descended below the glide slope on approach to Moscow's airport, claims from the U.S. that Bombardier is dumping the C-Series, and from Brazil that Bombardier is unfairly subsidized, a near miss between a Boeing 737 and a glider, and the Airbus Laminar Flow Wing Demonstrator takes flight. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 472 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody across the nation and across the world. Thank you for listening.
That's dramatic.
Well, I wanted, you know, I had to turn my radio voice on, you know.
Okay, it worked. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian, and he blogs at What Just Flew By. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Good to be back in good old Philly. I had a great weekend up in Toronto, but we can talk about that a little later.
Okay. Also joining us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Max. I just wanted to make a real quick shout out. Here in Las Vegas, we had a tragic event happened. And if anybody can donate blood, we'll donate blood. Please donate blood wherever you are around the world. Blood banks need it.
Yes. All right. And also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI author and a glass cockpit expert. Max, how are you?
I am doing excellent, though. Just as we started to record, I dumped over my glass of water, so I'm here cleaning everything up right now.
I thought I heard something going.
Other than that, but fortunately, this is radio, right? Nobody will see that.
That's right. Well, we're going to jump right in. We have a guest this episode, of course, and that's Paco Ubarreta. He's head of aircrew and testing, and he's the chief test pilot for Martin Aircraft Company. Now, the Martin Jetpack is an optionally piloted hovering air vehicle. It's currently being developed and tested in New Zealand. Paco has been an experimental test pilot for the U.S. Air Force, for Bombardier Aerospace, and Scaled Composites. He's a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School. He has over 4,400 total pilot hours and 44 different aircraft types with 1,000 instructor pilot hours, 600 flight test hours, and 460 combat hours. He holds an FAA ATPL, Transport Canada ATPL. He's a CFII, a CAA CPL. Boy, this is like alphabet soup, isn't it? Cat 1 test pilot certificate. He's got multiple type ratings in Boeing, Bombardier, Beechcraft, Mitsubishi jet aircraft. Paco was also the 2015 recipient of the Ivan C. Kinchlow Award for Outstanding Flight Test Accomplishments. That's the very prestigious award that was with Bombardier Commercial Aircraft. Paco, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here, and looking forward to the whole chat.
All right, very good. Now, we've had almost every problem known to podcasting befall us as we attempt to record this. So what we're going to do is we're going to jump right into the main topic in our conversation with Paco, and then after that, we'll come back to the news. All right, Paco, let's talk a little bit about jetpacks in general. And of course, Martin is developing this jetpack, but jetpacks are something that have been around for quite a long time, it seems, maybe in different variants or different flavors. What can you tell us about what's been tried in the past?
Well, it's interesting because with aviation and as the aerospace world is evolving, and there are creative and new ways of exploring human flight, semantics become important. And, you know, jetpacks really originated as a device worn as sort of like a backpack that the occupant or human pilot puts on and uses some kind of jet or gas to propel that human operator or pilot through the air. I think the concept emerged well before I was born. Back in the 1960s with science fiction. Probably most of you have seen things in science fiction or you know, there's the famous James Bond jetpack. And it was just a way to achieve what you can call a pilot without a plane. You know, astronauts have used similar devices in space with the extravehicular activities. That has happened. And I'd say the evolution of the jetpack has sort of oscillated, risen, and then gone down and turned into maybe several different types of devices and vehicles. We're starting to see sort of a wildcatting period, as we kind of call it in certain circles around here, of this new personal vertical takeoff and landing air vehicle campaign or era of really just the last couple of years. And we're at Martin Jetpack or Martin Aircraft, one of probably many approaches in a totally different type of personal air vehicle device. We see these hover bikes. We're seeing the drone era, quadcopter, personal quadcopter, and our vehicle, which is not really a backpack, but it's really a personal air vehicle that has a vertical takeoff and landing concept.
Hmm. Well, I kind of get the visceral appeal, if you will, of something like a jetpack. I mean, how cool is that? That's probably the closest thing to a human being actually flying. But what are the practical use cases? How will these things be used?
Well, I think it depends on the specific vehicle type and platform. If you have just the backpack type of purist jetpack, obviously, there are going to be advantages of the mobility of it and the light weight and compactness of it. But obviously, there could be limitations in terms of range and fuel load and payload capacity because there's only so much that a backpack-style jetpack can do. And I'll go to another example and stick to our prototyping product, which is more of a vehicle. It tends to be more of an aircraft, but a very small aircraft. We've evolved into using a landing gear. We have a flight control, a fly-by-wire system. We use, we're evolving our propulsion or power plant types, but the advantage of having more of a vehicle platform is payload, range, capacity, and mainly safety. With an actual vehicle, if the jetpack, so to speak, runs out of fuel, or more importantly and more critically, has a major system malfunction or emergency, we are in the works of developing an onboard manual or automatically deployed parachute system. And we also are developing our pilot safety module, which basically provides some level of protection in case of a catastrophic performance or flight control failure. So like any engineering project, there are trade-offs. And the smaller, the more compact, more of a backpack style you have advantages and disadvantages to that. And our approach, while more like a small vehicle, a personal air vehicle, it comes with a potential for more safety, range, platform, endurance, as well as, I'd say, utility and sort of answering into the question of use. We are casting a wide net. We see recreational, commercial, government, special mission, military, first responder, police, firefighting, agricultural, both manned and unmanned, or potentially mixed manned and unmanned formations in the use of our particular air vehicle that we're currently prototyping. And that goes the same with our future generation vehicle types.
Hmm. How do the regulatory agencies treat vehicles like this?
Yeah, so that's very interesting and important. The reality is that this is a very different type of vehicle that doesn't fall under a typical, say, small airplane Part 23 or light small helicopter Part 27 mold. There are different approaches depending on which regulatory agency we're discussing, because each regulatory agency is a little different. But the reality is we have to take some bits and pieces of existing regulatory precedents for some basic things in terms of, say, flying qualities or performance or failure state behavior and so forth. But then the reality is a lot of the traditional certification requirements for, say, an airplane or a helicopter actually just don't physically apply. And so we're taking a bit of a hybrid approach where we're tailoring some of our existing certification requirements to something that is safe and effective and reasonable for the striving of public safety for this particular vehicle type. And in most regulatory environments, the work to propose a certification basis lies with the applicant. In that case, it's us. And so we have to propose something that is safe, effective, reasonable for public safety, and also in the context of the scope of the aircraft environment. In other words, we may not want to be zipping around in jetpacks downtown city right away. We may probably take more of an incremental approach where we would propose to not jump right into a high-density urban environment right away and maybe take more of a what kind of the sort of Part 102 drone environment where you have to sort of stay away from busy airports and busy places to do what would be considered to be allowable operations for that commercial application of the new air vehicle. I think we have to, as a society, be open to allowing for a new vehicle type and have what is an appropriate certification requirement for something that is new. And I think we're going to help decide on what that is. But it is certainly not a simple, straightforward regulatory matter. But I think we've already engaged with the New Zealand CAA, as well as other regulatory agencies of the world. And I think they're quite aware of what we're proposing to do, but it's not something that we're going to have figured out and ready to fly jetpacks in, you know, downtown cities tomorrow. But I think everyone's aware that the era is coming.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I mean, certainly as we've seen with unmanned aircraft, with drones, it takes quite a while for the regulatory agencies to adapt and adopt the new technology.
And it should be. You know, I have an engineering background, and, you know, in any closed-loop system, you have a feed-forward element or path. But then, more importantly, you have a feedback loop, which is like regulatory. And so we can't just push into a new era without anyone really regulating and checking us and making sure that we're doing it safely.
Right.
So we have to keep in mind that as much as, you know, new companies and startups and entrepreneurs and inventors want the future today, it takes time, and rightfully so, because we have to do it safely, keeping in mind things like public safety, failures of systems, in highly dense populated areas, as well as other things like, you know, electromagnetic effects, other aircraft that are classically certified that may not have the systems to be aware of new vehicles, and they're operating at different, you know, energy levels that could actually be quite dangerous to both, and then to the people below. So we have to do it in a reasonable way, but I think we have the right minds on it from both industry and government and military. I think people are thinking about it, and I think we'll find a way forward, but we'll do it in the right way.
How many engines are there that power the jetpack, Paco?
Do you mean the Martin products?
Yes. Well, I mean, like the jetpack specifically, is that a single power plant or more than one?
So in the Martin aircraft models, and I'll stick to that if that's okay in terms of answering this particular question, it is a single power plant that drives one belt. And the approach that the product has evolved into is basically a twin-ducted fan powered by at present, a single power plant.
Wow. So taking it as a fixed-wing pilot for a minute, what would the result be if that power plant were to fail when you're 300 feet in the air?
Yeah, exactly. So in testing, what we do is we keep things low and slow from a, say, structural safety standpoint in case there is a single point failure. And yet we're in development and testing of a parachute system that obviously it's not a zero-zero parachute, but it would, at certain heights and speeds, would aspirationally, manually, or automatically deploy in case of that single point failure. That being said, our products are in R&D, prototyping, experimental flight testing. And, you know, our company has evolved dramatically. We went from something that was very, very small into something that is trying to become a professional aircraft manufacturing organization. So we're trying to make this a commercialized or certifiable product. We're not there today. We won't be there tomorrow. But with something that a lot of the team that's been here for about a year, year and a half to 2 years has been trying to make an aircraft that started with one engine powering twin-ducted fans into something that has all these safety features such as something equivalent or meeting what would be sort of a graceful degradation of a catastrophic failure in a single engine airplane glide, or an auto rotation graceful degradation equivalent to something like a single engine light helicopter. Well, you know, our initial thoughts were parachute. Of course, a parachute won't cater for every scenario. And in future aspirations, the team is certainly brainstorming on partial power or alternate power sources that would cater for or basically back up a single point catastrophic failure state, as you mentioned. Now, currently in testing, we have a single power plant, twin-ducted fans, and yet we're flying. And so it's kind of like, how are you doing that? Well, what we're doing is we're flying very low and very slow over land in case we have a problem. No significant damage or injury to the pilot has been analyzed. So it's basically walking pace with just a few meters above the ground. When we go higher and do true envelope expansion or demonstrations, particularly in manned flight, which is what I participate in, is done over water. And it's done at heights and speeds that we have tested and analyzed to say there shouldn't be an injury to the pilot at those higher speeds. So it's not like we're going at 300 feet AGL at, you know, 50 knots. We're not doing that. We're doing things where we're at 30 knots, something like that, a few meters above water. And the pilots wear helmets, neck braces, armor. And the pilot module has actually been designed in this series of aircraft that we're currently testing to provide a level of pilot safety. So I hope that kind of answers broadly the question.
Okay, so then one follow-up to that. What did you think the first time you flew this thing? What was the word that came to your mind?
Exhilarating.
Did you feel like James
Bond? There's more words, but I mean, that's the first one. So as a pilot, I've flown different types, military and civilian, different types. And one of the things that drew me here was, well, I haven't flown anything like a so-called jetpack or hover air vehicle or whatever you want to, whatever semantic we decide to use. And that attracted me. So I would say, if I could have it my way, and I'm just putting my pure pilot hat on, I would do that all day. Because, you know, I'm sort of quoting one of the Iron Man movie. How about a pilot without the plane? You know, it is a pure open air, vertical takeoff, wind in your face, visual VMC, VFR environment. You know, while we have the normal hazards of developmental, experimental flight testing, I would say the overall experience is highly exhilarating.
Paco, is it a difficult vehicle to fly?
Well, that is a really important question. So what I believe is that our company and our engineers have really cracked the code in using fly-by-wire. And I would say that our aircraft today is extremely easy to pilot. We have developmental areas to improve the way it handles and its performance envelope and so forth. But broadly speaking, in the current vehicle that I've been flying in flight testing and in the envelope that we've expanded out to and the maneuvers that we've done, it is about 4 times easier than a light helicopter. In other words, I can fly with one hand and control roll, pitch, and yaw single-handed with obviously no rudder inputs because I'm standing up. And we've put the primary longitudinal, lateral, and directional axis controls on the right stick. And it is extremely intuitive and easy to fly in concept, even for the non-pilot. We have operable simulators, and we get visitors, potential customers, potential partners, vendors, you name it. And what's interesting to me is when I host those visitors in the simulator, which is pretty close, I'd say pretty close to the real experience. It's never going to be perfect in terms of simulator to aircraft with all the noise and the air and things like that. But it's a pretty good part test trainer. And all of them find it quite intuitive to fly, which is the step that we're trying to get to is, you know, this new age of personal aircraft. We want it to be more accessible to someone than just a commercial or airline transport pilot license holder. This is something where initially we know we're going to go for maybe an ex-military or CPL license holder, but aspirationally, we'd like to get this to more of a recreational private pilot holder. Because you don't need a lot of those knowledge and skill sets to get to an ATPL to operate aspirationally what we'd like to commercialize here at Martin Aircraft. So we're trying to make it as intuitive and low workload as possible, and that's probably the crux of the handling qualities and flying qualities envelope expansion testing that I'm doing, is seeing this in a way to make it as small of a training footprint and learning curve as possible, not just for an ATP holder, but for any person.
Hmm. Brian, I think you had a question.
Yeah, with the single power plant, I was wondering, what's producing more noise? Is it the engine or is it the two ducted fans that are on the vehicle? And how loud is it, really?
Yeah, that is an interesting question because it depends on where you're standing and how you're measuring it. And that's to broadly answer that. But what's important is to the occupant or the pilot and to the people that are nearby. And at present, it's loud. It's not at the level that we expect it to be, or would, I would say, from a regulatory standpoint, require it to be, you know, in a commercial product. But bear in mind, we just finished design and build of this, I will call it actually a proof of concept vehicle, really just this year. And it was this vehicle is not initially intended to go into a full certification program. It serves as the basis or concept demonstrator, proof of concept, and prototype of a few of those, of this series. And it's really the next vehicle in which our, you know, all the really smart people and our engineers and partners are looking into what is going to be the certifiable solution for something that has the noise at a an acceptable level for more of a actual commercialized or certified use. So admittedly, it's loud, and depending on where you stand, it's going to be dependent on is that the power plant or is that the docks or is it both? We take noise measurements. I will say it's at a level that's safe and accepted at both company and regulatory levels for experimental flight testing. And I do wear levels of noise protection to keep my hearing, you know, and the levels around my head in terms of noise down to a place where it's basically completely safe, but it's not aspirational. I mean, it's mainly to just get the proof of concept going and collect data, which is all part of a normal test program.
Now, this is being designed as an optionally piloted air vehicle. It's interesting that you know, Martin has taken that approach. What's the logic there? Why design something that works both manned and unmanned?
It's really interesting. I think there are several, you know, reasons for it, and it's all new, and that's what's exciting about it, and that's largely why I'm here. So one reason is to be safer and less risky in endangering a manned test pilot, you know, in certain phases of the experimental test program. So, you know, when you're just trying to get something in the air, you don't necessarily need to risk a human if you've already thought that, okay, well, we could optionally remotely pilot that particular vehicle. And so that's one aspect. The other aspect is actually on the other end of the spectrum, and that's the end use. As I had mentioned before, we're in this wildcatting period of these kind of VTOL air vehicles to include UAV, RPAS, UCAV, UAS, drones, whatever semantic you want to use, but some type of unmanned air vehicle. And where is that going to end? We don't know. But this end product has the potential to be what we call like a medium or heavy lift drone or smart wingman or optionally piloted mule or piloted aircraft that you can make unmanned at your whim. So it's sort of like, you know, for maybe a cheesy phrase, it's sort of like have it your way. Why? Because we don't know necessarily where it's going, because the entire industry hasn't exactly chosen singly a path. But the advantage of it is we're actually already doing unmanned work for the sake of making a test program potentially more safer. So why not carry that through as something that is commercially viable? Now, we also understand that the regulatory environment may make it more complex to have a vehicle that's optionally piloted as opposed to just man-piloted. And so it's interesting, we work with drone regulations as well as manned pilot regulations, knowing that these normally don't coalesce in a traditional regulatory certification and even operationally or even maintenance environment, because the UAV or unmanned or drone or RPAS systems are still in their infancy and regulations are evolving to keep up with the changes. So we know that it's going to be an interesting and sometimes challenging product to get out there, but we have the technology. So why wouldn't we leverage it to make things safer and more commercially selectable to potential customers?
Is there a timeline that Martin has in mind for the next steps? I know it's difficult to predict.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say there's a timeline. There are timelines.
Yeah.
And so let's put it this way. In any test program and any organizations that's trying to do something new, there are many different timelines depending on which part of the company you're asking. We have to understand the reality of the complexity of something that we're doing. And it's something that has really, I don't think it's really been ever done before in this way. And that's what makes it exciting. So we have aspirational timelines. We have, of course, where the different certification authorities timelines might be. We have proof of concept, our current experimental test program, both manned and unmanned timelines. We have vendor timelines. We have partner timelines. We have major shareholder timelines. So there are probably a myriad, dozens of timelines that we could talk about. But what's important to me is that we're moving in the right direction in all those timelines, and that we have to understand that the only constant is change and to be not surprised by surprises. So we are constantly adapting where yesterday's and last year's timelines are to the realities of today. And yet, I don't think we've really changed our vision and goal from the last couple of months and from the last, say, maybe 2 years of trying to get something completely new in a regulatory environment that is still evolving to this new age of, you know, personal flying or VTOL air vehicles or devices or jetpacks or flying cars or manned drones or hover bikes or whatever you want to call it. And yet, in all, I think everyone's kind of moving in the right, grossly same direction. And so that part is exciting. It's a whole other discussion to talk about the timelines, but it's a resounding yes. There are timelines.
Because I can imagine that with any kind of a development program as complex as this, that, yeah, first of all, it's difficult to project when will the product be commercially available. But it sounds like there's quite a bit still to be done, and we're probably talking some years into the future, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can honestly talk in terms of years. But I have timelines for this week. I have timelines for, you know, the next month.
Sure.
What kind of flight testing are we going to be doing? What kind of customer demonstrations are we going to be doing? You know, what type of design, development, build, and ground testing? And I will say that in both macro and microscopic ways, everything is moving and moving forward. And the goal is still we endeavor to reach some kind of market entry, whether it's in a, you know, purely civilian commercial application or something that is actually more of a special mission type of category. We are casting a wide net and everything's on the table at this point, but we are moving in the right direction.
And what's the price point for each of those markets?
The reality is it's hard to put unit costs this soon, and I'm definitely not the money guy. You know, like I just fly around and test the aircraft and give you my opinion about how it flies and, you know, get data for the test engineers and validate and verify the design and do all those things. When you're doing deep R&D, it costs money. And you don't necessarily get the revenue or any type of thing back right away. That takes time and care to make the product right. And I'd say we're in the very early stages of what is research and development to get to a viable, commercializable product. But if you look on the website, we have put out, and I'm just talking about ballpark, hundreds of thousands of dollars per unit. You know, that's kind of the ballpark. I think it's anywhere from 100 to 300, depending on what page on the website and what time you were looking at the website for our particular vehicle. But the reality is, okay, that assumes it's a totally typed, certificated vehicle, and these are coming out like hotcakes. The amount of investment that goes into the R&D and testing to get to that unit cost, as you know, is well over that.
Sure.
It's a difficult question at this point. And the other thing I would add is, you know, aspirationally, we want to make a vehicle that is tailorable to a customer. So we don't want to make just a vanilla jetpack and then you can only do this with it. To me, especially as we're casting a wide net in terms of mission utility, there might be a customer that wants to use it for a special mission, some type of delivery system. There might be a customer that wants to use it purely as a commercial recreational vehicle. There might be someone that wants to use it to inspect wind turbines or pipelines. There might be customers that want to use it as purely a drone. And so would the costs per unit vary with that? It might. And we're open to that. But I think in the early stage of our, you know, commercialized vehicle, we have to be ready for that. And the costs that vary with those mission or task tailored types, unfortunately, that's not my lane to talk about. I'm not the money guy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is very exciting as well. And I have to imagine that it's personally exciting for you. I mean, you've done a lot of exciting things in your career, I think, with respect to aircraft that you've flown. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, this is something that has a certain attraction to it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I do have, the privilege of having the diverse experience. And I do fly, you know, regular airplanes here regularly for my own proficiency, as well as light helicopters. And the reason for that is because we don't want to make the mistake of being biased in, well, a jetpack should fly like this because when I used to fly, you know, airplanes. Or no, a jetpack needs to be like this because when I used to fly helicopters. Like, it shouldn't be that way. We want to take a holistic and sort of open-minded approach to human flight. You know, I don't think we should be stovepiped from paradigms of the past. You know, the way I describe the way this vehicle presently flies in many ways and aspirationally will fly is it's a bit like a bumblebee. It doesn't seem to have the right to fly. It doesn't have wings. It doesn't have fixed or rotary airfoils, yet it maneuvers with a high level of agility, and it does it so easily. And instead of having, you know, this 3 million years of insect evolution through Darwin, we figured it out with fly-by-wire, with really smart flight controls, propulsion, structural, aeronautical engineers. A nice, bright, but small team. And we're definitely onto something.
Fascinating stuff. Well, of course, those of you listening can learn more about this at the website. That's martinjetpack.com. There's a lot of photos, some videos that are there. We'll also have those, as well as links to those in the show notes on our site. Paco, in those pictures, the guy in the orange suit, is that you?
Guess what I'm wearing right now? that same orange suit.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's me. The Series 1 man chief test pilot is myself, and I wear that orange flight suit, or, you know, it's not the only one I have, but and we do that for good reason. Obviously, it's flight test safety orange. It's also so quite comfortable, especially when you strap on an air vehicle like that.
Well, Paco, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I know we had a lot of trouble getting connected at the start.
Oh, it's all good.
Yeah, we finally did. So it worked out in the end. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, no worries. next time you guys are out in New Zealand, feel free to drop by and hop in for a simulator, or we can show you one of our flight tests.
Oh, I would love to. New Zealand's beautiful. I did visit New Zealand once, Christchurch.
Yeah, that's where we're located.
Besides the jetpack, that's another another draw for you, I'm sure.
There's no greater place to do some flying is New Zealand. It is a beautiful country.
I'm going to be there not this November, but next November, so I'll be sure to look you up. Now, the other question I had is, and sorry I didn't ask this before, doing your TICE float over water, how terrified are you of something going wrong and drowning? Or what protection is there that will keep you and or the vehicle buoyant long enough for the safety team to get there to take care of you?
Oh, absolutely not terrified. I've been a competitive swimmer from a very young age, so I'm very comfortable in the water. The other part is the composite material of the ducts in particular are very floatable. The other aspect is we put flotation devices on the pilot module of the vehicle. We did that on our previous prototype known as P12, which is, if you look on the website, it's sort of the maroon one. It has the maroon ducts, which I flew that 11 times, and we had that type of water flotation safety devices on there and the floatability of the structure itself. And then I also wear a life vest or a flotation vest that inflates. And, oh, by the way, the vehicle flotation devices are automatic flotation safety devices, whereas the one I put on my neck is manually. And the other thing is safety is paramount. So we always treat it like a high-risk test because it is. Therefore, we have a boat with divers as well as a medical team on site for any of our manned flights, particularly over water. So we're ready for anything. I wouldn't use the word terrified. In fact, I feel very comfortable flying. And very comfortable with, given the energy states that we are flying over water, very comfortable in case there's any failure state while in flight that ends up into a forced water landing.
That's great.
All right. Thanks again.
Great to chat to you guys and hope to see you guys soon.
Brian, can I buy some miles from you to go to New Zealand?
New Zealand's beautiful. Oh, man.
Sounds like a fun simulator ride.
You said you're going to New Zealand? You just got back from...
Not this November, next November.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
He lives a charmed life in the back of an airplane.
A year from now.
So do you think you'd do it on United again?
Probably Air New Zealand.
No.
I don't know yet. Haven't decided.
Yeah. All right, guys, now it's time for the news.
Is everybody ready?
All right, well, this is the Airplane Geeks podcast, and there are a lot of airplanes in the news this past week. There's A380 news, C-Series news, something with the Boeing 737, the A340, lots of airplanes in the news. So why don't we get started first with the big one, the A380. And I think by now, most of you listening have seen the news reports that an Air France A380 had to make an emergency landing after an engine problem. This was an understatement. This was Air France Flight 66 flying from Paris to Los Angeles with 497 passengers on board. And while over the Atlantic at 37,000 feet, one of the engines experienced some kind of an event. I'm not sure what caused this, but really the front end of the engine suddenly was not attached to the engine.
It looks like the fan disintegrated.
Well, it's different than that. You know, normally when you have an event like this, it's something strikes the engine, damages a rotating part like a fan blade or a turbine blade or a compressor blade that breaks the blade, sends it to the rest of the engine. When you talk about an uncontained failure, the engines are designed so that when you have an event like that, the metal that's churning around, ripping apart inside the engine, doesn't leave the engine out through the case, impact the wing, the fuselage, anything like that. And this one was described as an uncontained engine failure by some of the early reports. But, you know, I wouldn't call this an uncontained engine failure. This is more like an in-flight disassembly.
Yeah, it's like the front third of the engine is just gone. I mean, I've never seen a picture like this before where there's, you know, you're looking into the inside of the back two-thirds of the engine.
That's right. The fan is completely missing.
It's like someone took a Ginsu knife to the front of that engine.
Yeah.
Very bizarre. Now, the engine in this particular case is an engine alliance engine. On A380s, you have the option of engines produced by Engine Alliance or by Rolls-Royce. Engine Alliance is a 50-50 joint venture between Pratt & Whitney and GE, although there are some other revenue-sharing partners. This was an Engine Alliance engine. You may recall an earlier incident on the A380, the Qantas flight that had an uncontained engine failure. That was back in 2010. And I think this is the only other event like this. But
that was a Rolls-Royce, I think, wasn't it?
Exactly. That was a Rolls-Royce engine in that case. But yeah, when you look at the photos, the fan is missing. You can see the fan exit guide vanes. You can see the compressor, the front end of the compressor. Now, with an engine like this, it really is an international engine. The different components, different modules are made by different companies in different countries. And if you go to the Engine Alliance website, they actually have a really nice graphic where you can click on the different engine sections, and it highlights that section, shows you who built that. When you look at the low-pressure compressor built by Safran, and then look at some of the photos, it looks like the front part of that compressor is where that fracture is. So I can't tell if this was a problem with the fan, a problem with the compressor, maybe a shaft failure. I'm not sure. Really looking forward to seeing, you know, what the analysis of this brings. But it really is a very strange kind of a failure.
Hey, let's talk about what happened with the passengers. I was following a couple of them on Twitter all day yesterday, and it was really amazing. So they arrived in Goose Bay, you know, basically 520 people on this aircraft. The customs facility at Goose Bay says that they can handle 15 people. So they are not set up for airline flights. So they didn't let them off the plane. They sat there on the airplane. Now, finally, they brought in a chartered 737 and then later a 777. So the first class and business passengers left first on the 737 with a few people that were plucked from economy. The person I was following on Twitter said, unfortunately, nobody with, you know, kids. So I guess he was hoping they would get to go, but they didn't. Anyway, the 777, rather than going to Los Angeles, which was their final destination, went first to Atlanta, where they then were split out onto different flights. Now, from the time the people who went on the 777, arrived in Goose Bay to the time they arrived in Los Angeles was over 24 hours. Now, these guys had been up all night, I guess, you know, on the flight coming over. They spent 24 hours on top of their, you know, flight to get home. Now, the guys that were in first class, they beat them by 18 hours. So it's kind of interesting that they were able to get the first class people there fast.
Interesting. Of course, the A380 is a four-engine plane, and flying with only three engines is not a big deal at all, as long as the engine that you that's not operating has not damaged the aircraft, of course.
Well, it depends on where you are, though. I mean, it doesn't fly near as well with three engines, and I'm sure they couldn't maintain the cruise altitude they were at when the engine went. Which means when you get down lower, you burn a lot more gas.
Sure.
But that is part of the planning process. But still, it gets a little dicey.
Yeah, just to give you an idea of how dicey this was, after this aircraft landed, and there's a video available of it landing at Goose Bay, they had to go out onto the runway and clean off the excess parts that fell off the airplane as it landed.
See, what I'm really surprised at is the lack of damage done to the wing. When you have that much of an engine go flying off, I'm assuming, in every direction, not to do more damage to the wing is just amazing to me.
That's a really good point. If you go back and look at the damage done to the wing on that Qantas airplane years ago, I mean, it was serious the way some of those parts ended up coming through the wing.
My suspicion is, in this case, the front end of the engine left as one piece, or largely one piece. I don't think it exploded. I think you had some kind of a stress fracture or some kind of a fracture that just, with the force, just liberated the entire thing. The fan case and the front part of the nacelle. I think that probably came out as one piece, because if it really had exploded in all directions, then yeah, it would have punctured the wing, the fuselage, everything. I imagine we'll never find that fan, and it's too bad there's no video of that thing leaving, because I don't think anybody has ever seen anything like that in the past. But we have another A380 story reported in the Australian. This is Sirius Moscow A380 incident investigated. This is a different kind of an issue. And here we see that the Emirates General Civil Aviation Authority, they're investigating an Emirates A380 that, quote, descended below the glide scope on approach. And that was coming into Moscow's Doma de Dovo, or something like that, airport. This was Emirates flight 131. But they descended to 400 feet when they were just a little under 15 kilometers away. They aborted that approach. They made a second unsuccessful attempt to land, and then they finally landed the thing safely. So that's being investigated. That kind of sounds like maybe there's a crew issue with this one.
Yeah, you'd think they probably weren't flying the visual approach, but if they were, someone really screwed up. You know, at 14.8 kilometers, that translates out to a little bit more than 9 miles. And at 9 miles, you should be roughly 2,200 feet. So, yeah, these guys were incredibly low. And that must have scared the daylights out of anybody who was, you know, on the ground out there.
Yeah, I'm sure. An A380 at 400 feet.
Did they say what the weather was?
I don't think so. But that would obviously, yeah, Rob, that would be an interesting point to know about this.
You mean outside it was frightful where the fire was so delightful? This is Russia we're talking about.
So I just wonder with that one if it really has to do with the inexperienced flight crews. Again, a friend of mine went to go fly for Emirates, and he didn't have very much time before he got put in the right seat. And I just wonder, with them growing so much and needing so many pilots, if they just didn't have the experience and weren't paying attention. And heck, what went wrong to be so far off?
That's why I was asking about the weather, because if the weather was visual, I mean, how they could have gotten that low and been able to look out the window would be pretty tough to explain. Now, if they were in the clouds, okay, that kind of throws a different slant on it. Still not very good, but, you know, it's an interesting point that you make.
Yeah, and Brian might be onto something there. I don't know about you, Rob, when you were learning to fly, but I think it took me quite some time before I knew what a 3-degree glide slope looked like and I could fly one. It was long after I got my private pilot's license. So to me, it's entirely conceivable that you could have somebody with 250 hours in the right seat of an aircraft who still doesn't have a really good idea of what that 3-degree glide slope looks like, you know, 5, 4, and 3 miles out.
Yeah, but 10 miles out, they wouldn't have been hand-flying that airplane, I don't think. I mean, they would have. I mean, especially Airbus. I mean, those things are designed to be computer-flown. I mean, it's possible, but who knows? We may find that somebody misset the automation.
Yeah, that's pretty likely.
Well, I mean, come on. Don't you have glide slopes? And when these A380s come along, isn't there somebody with paddles on the end of the deck going, you're too low, you're too low, pull up, pull up? I mean, come on. The Navy's been doing it the right way all these years. Why can't you civilian pilots get on board?
Just need the meatball. We'll follow it.
Yeah. Call the ball.
All right, moving on. Bombardier's in the news with the C-Series, and we've talked in the past about Boeing's claim that Bombardier is dumping C-Series aircraft in the U.S., selling it below cost. Now we see that the U.S. Commerce Department has looked at this and is apparently sympathetic to Boeing's complaint of dumping on the part of Bombardier.
Boy, were there a bunch of pissed off Canadians where I was this week.
You were in Toronto.
I was in Toronto, the home of Bombardier. There was a lot of upset Canadians, and they're more upset by the fact that they've poured money into the company because Bombardier has – it's really not the airplanes that the problem is. It's the railroads. They're upset that now that Bombardier is getting penalized because they're paying Bombardier to produce airplanes and they can't sell them in the States. And everybody's going, what's Boeing's problem?
The Commerce Department is recommending is, and this is a preliminary decision, but what they're recommending is a 220% tariff on Bombardier, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd. I mean, if I were Boeing, I would be sitting there going, "Uh-oh." You know, Delta is going to be upset with Boeing because they have this this deal for what, about 70, 80 airliners. I mean, I bet Boeing is just aghast and you know, there would be a lot of blowback if this really goes to 220%. I mean, 20% somebody gets, but 220, that's nuts.
And to make matters worse, I'm sure Boeing Defense Division, who was about to sell 24 F-18s to Canada, and that deal is blown out of the proportion, is clearly pissed off at the Boeing Airline Division because they're the ones that brought up this whole thing. So yeah. This whole thing doesn't make any sense. Somebody needs to take a step back from the breach and revisit this.
And David, what about the bit that they're not even in that market space any longer? Right when Boeing got rid of the 717, they don't have a competitive product.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, this goes back to the sale of the 75 CS-100s that Delta purchased from Bombardier last year. And yeah, that makes this even more bizarre, is that Boeing did not compete not effectively with any kind of an aircraft in this campaign with Delta. So, I mean, how were they harmed? The other thing about this is that it's so ironic because so much of this industry involves sales with special discounts. Well, here's an example. Let's say that you're developing something brand new, like a geared turbofan engine. And let's say that you devote 20 years and just hypothetically $2 billion to developing that engine. When you sell the first one, what should the price be?
Not $2 billion.
Not $2 billion. Of course not. You know, the development costs get allocated forward in some manner. Now, there are different accounting rules in different countries. And, you know, there's no apples-to-apples comparison. So, I mean, you could argue that, well, you know, if you sell the engine for, I don't know, $2 million, $4 million, $8 million, you're selling it below cost. Are you dumping? Well, no, of course not. It doesn't make sense that Boeing is taking this tack, especially because if they persist in this, just wait. At some point in the future, someone else will be able to say to Boeing, you're doing the same thing that you accuse the other guys of doing. So,
yeah, I bet Boeing really regrets now having even brought this action. I mean, it's almost like you know, tattling on your neighbor for you know, breaking the homeowners association rules, and he goes to prison for 40 years. I mean, to me, the penalty is just so out of, you know, reach that it's just ridiculous.
Now, if somebody can explain to me why this makes a lot of sense, I'd love to hear it, whether from Boeing or from anyone else. So, if you can justify what Boeing seems to be doing here, I'd love to hear it. But that's not all for Bombardier, because, of course, another competitor is Embraer. And Brazil has asked the WTO, the World Trade Organization, to investigate Canada's alleged use of more than $3 billion in government subsidies. And Brazil is claiming that the loans, the equity infusions, the grants, the tax credits for Bombardier harm Embraer. But here again, I mean, that's what every country does, right? You have tax incentives. You have military programs that in the end end up funding technology used commercially. That's another form of subsidy. These countries and these companies like to have these trade battles over aviation, but they just don't make sense to me.
Yeah, and the weird part is usually these things come to nothing, right? It's like a push. And here it's like, whoa, they actually are, you know, talking about applying a huge, huge penalty.
Yeah, so. All right, well, we have a 737, a Boeing 737 in the news. And Max T, tell us about this United Airlines flight.
Yeah, pretty simple. UA 737 headed to Chicago O'Hare from Vancouver, Canada, reported they had to take evasive action to avoid colliding with a glider near the destination. Now, they reported seeing the glider near Rockford, Illinois, and they say the Boeing had to climb 400 feet to avoid it. And I think they also ended up making a 360. When you look at the flight track, there's some pretty strange, you know, circles going on there. But Rob, do they do gliders around Rockford? What do you know about that?
Well, I was trying to think about that. I remember when I used to fly out of Midway regularly, we had a place out west of west southwest of Chicago we worried about. I can't think of a glider port that is right over that way. But that doesn't mean anything. I mean, gliders often go out and stay aloft for 2, 3, 5, 6, 8 hours. And, you know, make cross-country flights. We don't even know where that airplane was from.
Well, and they're outside the Class Bravo there, right? So presumably the so the glider doesn't even need a transponder, which means they're basically invisible to radar. And so then you're relying on the pilots looking out the windows to see and avoid.
I just want to say that, you know, this was a manned aircraft without a transponder flying in Class B airspace, and there was a danger of it hitting an airliner. Where have I heard that scenario from?
that wasn't in Class B.
But still, your point is they're talking about drones doing the same kind of things gliders are doing, right?
No, that wouldn't be my point at all, would it? Yeah. I guess it would be. Yeah, you're right. Okay, back to the A340.
All right, the A340. Airbus has a very special A340. This is part of the test program that they call BLADE, B-L-A-D-E. That's the Breakthrough Laminar Aircraft Demonstrator in Europe. And this is part of the Clean Sky Research Program that's sponsored by the EU. And Brian, they're testing some interesting things with it as well.
Well, the aircraft looks fine. It's the wing that looks a little bizarre to me. So it looks like they're having some new materials and trying to have airflow over the wing and make it a little bit more efficient. And they're talking about, what, a 4% or so fuel improvement. Sounds pretty good to me.
You also lower CO2 emissions. A lot of this comes from maintaining a laminar flow over the wing. Now, I'm by no means an expert on that, this aircraft, they call it Flight Lab, and they have two outer wings kind of attached to the ends of the wings that sort of extend them out, and these are all fully instrumented. That allows them to calculate a lot of, or to capture a lot of data, and try to look at the laminar flow, the transonic laminar flow. We might have a photo of that in the show notes for you to look at. And there's also a news release from Airbus. We'll put a link to that in there as well, so you can check this out.
Yeah, and I think this ties in a story that we covered a while back about the material that they were planning on putting on the wing to not have bugs stick to the leading edge. And again, cleaning up the air surface so you have a nice smooth airflow over the wing and improve efficiency that way.
Yeah, but you can also remember that having the smoothest possible wing doesn't always necessarily give you the best laminar flow. I mean, there've been a number of cases where, you know, folks have actually roughened up the leading surface, and that it's kind of like a golf ball in the sense that the little dimples provide better laminar flow around it. So, yeah, you don't want to just get it perfectly smooth. You got to figure out where to put the roughness in on the leading edge to get better laminar flow.
All right. Well, we'll follow this. Love the technology development. We've seen big jumps in fuel economy for aircraft, emission reductions. And one of the points here is that the industry is not done by any means when it comes to getting even greater efficiency out of aircraft. This is one more example of that.
Yeah, and it's not just engines. There are multiple bits of technology that are contributing to these efficiencies, and that's pretty neat, I think.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. So the aircraft are getting more efficient, but the seats are getting more narrow.
Yes.
The airlines would say that would be more efficient.
Yeah, exactly. Not for my knees, it's not.
Oh, and by the way, guys, we've been doing laminar flow for years.
Sure.
I can't find what?
I mean, laminar flow,
the NASA tested that back on a B-66 back in the 60s. This is not new technology. This is another one of those. This is, you need the historian to tell you that what's old is new again. The X-21A was the NASA laminar flow wing based on the Douglas B-66.
So David, do you think that NASA had it all figured out back then and Airbus is wasting their money?
No, if NASA had it all figured out back then, it would be in production everywhere. I think they learned a lot, like what Max said, that a super clean wing isn't necessarily the optimal wing.
Yeah, and they may have found new ways to get better flow. You know, when I was talking about the seats being crammed in, I must be thinking about an article I just read a day or so ago. I don't know if you guys saw it, but JetBlue is going to be re-outfitting all their aircraft to stick in two more rows of seats, and American Airlines is doing something similar. So it's like, the sardines are becoming even more tightly packed.
I was perfectly happy spending an extra $10 on my flight each way for an extra 6 inches of leg room. It made the world a difference.
That's what they want. Yeah, I've moved to the same thing.
Were you an economy plus, David, or did you move up a full?
No, I did economy plus. The first couple of rows in Air Canada in cattle class have extra space. So I had a good 3 inches between my knees and the front of the seat and the back of the seat in front of me.
Hmm. And all that for $10, huh?
Yeah.
Wow. Of course, there's $10 more they squeeze out of you, but
it's either that or they would have to carry me off the airplane because they would have squeezed the life out of me. Yeah. So $10 is worth it, as far as I'm concerned.
And hey, Rob, $10 is $10, huh?
$10. Yeah.
That was the joke you read in our show. $10 is $10.
Well, actually, $10 American, so it was really like $11.20 Canadian. No, okay. Let's put it that way.
All right. Just to be accurate.
What about – we didn't even mention what went out of business today?
Monarch. Yep.
Yeah, Monarch did, and that leaving thousands stranded. Another big story is on the FAA reauthorization bill. And we saw, this is kind of breaking news, I guess, is that what the Congress has done is pass, I don't know, Rob, this is a continuing resolution. Is that what you would call this for 6 months?
Sure. As they like to say here in the States, they kick the can down the road.
Yep. Didn't have to deal with it until 6 months from now. Then they have to deal with it.
It's kind of not a big surprise, although, you know, it is sort of ironic that one of the arguments made by those who want to separate air traffic control from the FAA is that, of course, that's a vital function. And to keep them under this threat of, you know, the funding running out is not good. And so they say, well, let's just take it out of the, you know, out of the scope of the FAA. And that solves that problem. My problem with that is, it doesn't solve the real problem. The real problem, it seems to be Congress' inability to do their job, which is to provide funding in a timely manner.
I heard something on the radio today where somebody repeated almost exactly what you said, Max, except that congressional representative said, no, I'm sorry, not a congressional representative. The commenter said, It's time for Congress to get their ass in gear.
You know, this bill failed earlier in the week last week before it finally passed, and it was because there were items that were not related to the bill that were loaded in there, and finally they were able to get through when they stripped most but not all of those out. I mean, I think that's the real problem. Every time people see a bill they think might pass, they put their pet projects in it because they know that's the only way they're going to get them through, and that's just a crazy way to create legislation.
Yeah, and isn't that justification for a line item veto?
Yep.
Yeah, but that's a lot of work.
You have to read the legislation then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to pass it before you know what's in it.
Yeah. All right, quickly, what's up with the geeks? Rob, you've got some traveling coming up, don't you?
It's NBAA next week, and unfortunately, in all places, of all places, it's in Las Vegas.
Mm.
But hopefully they will have the situation better in hand by then. But it is the National Business Aviation Association's annual convention. Usually about 30,000 people show up to the event. And so who knows what we're going to see. And then the following week, I'm out at your alma mater there, Mr. Max, at Cornell.
Yes.
Up in
Ithaca, New York. Have they asked you to come speak up there? Or are you just going up and going to stand there and, you know?
Contrary to popular belief, no, I did not. I did not pay them. Yeah, I'm going to go to Cornell for the local chapter of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics.
Nice.
And they said they're all engineers that are coming to hear me talk about communication and in the aviation industry.
Does that make you nervous? Said,
oh, boy, a bunch of engineers.
Max, do we tell him that, like, Ithaca is, like, ground central for UAV technology in upstate New York? It's, like, everywhere up there.
It is.
I thought that was Syracuse.
Well, Syracuse, Ithaca, the whole corridor is now UAS.
Well, I'll just keep my head down.
All right. Brian, you've also been getting out and about.
Yeah, I was at the Huntington Beach Air Show over the weekend. So it was the second annual, and what an improvement over the first showing. So I think they really learned a bunch of lessons and put on a great air show. There was just a little bit of an issue with fog on Friday. The Blue Angels and the Snowbirds couldn't do their practice run, so that was unfortunate. But on Saturday, the fog lifted right at the right time, and they put on a great show. The Orange County Sheriff's Department was there. The Coast Guard did their water rescue. FedEx had a 757. There was the F-16, F-35, P-51 that did the Heritage flight. C-47, the Army skydiving team, the Black Daggers, were there, and of course the Royal Canadian Air Force Snowbirds, and that was the first time I got to see them. So that was an awful lot of fun, and a bunch of others that I don't recall off the top of my head.
Okay,
so would you say that the weather conditions that caused the training flight to be canceled, would that the fog, would that be spelled F-A-G or F-A-A-G? Fog?
Okay, Rob, you realize that you've currently offended half the universe and the other ones wants to smoke right now, right?
Well, that's probably true, except that I do think it would probably be spelled F-A-A-G. Fog?
Yeah, that's why we call it the marine layer.
Yes. And, Brian, I need to correct you.
Okay.
The United States Army parachute team is the United States Army Golden Knights.
Right.
The United States Special Operation Command's parachute demonstration team is commonly known as the Daggers. They were the Special Operations Command, not the Golden Knights.
So someone at the show told me that they changed their names, and I never heard that before. So thank you, because I didn't know. And so the Golden Knights are still jumping and doing their thing. Awesome.
United States Parachute Team, United States Army Parachute Team, or the USAPT, is the Golden Knights. The Daggers are the Special Operations Command. Just like the Leapfrogs are the Navy.
And they did an awesome job. It was really fun to watch them.
I'm jealous. I haven't seen the Snowbirds in so long. I miss that. They are my favorite team.
Ian, do we have a recording here, Brian?
We do. And as a good intro to that, there was a mini meetup. So I met with Ray Johnson, who was on the show in episode 434. One of the bits of law that he practices is aviation law. And I met up with him and had my microphone with me. So I recorded a little piece with Ray. Hi, this is Associate Producer Brian Coleman. I'm here at the Huntington Beach Air Show meeting with Ray Johnson. And if you remember, Ray was on the show. Ray is an aviation attorney. Ray, welcome to the show.
Hello, Brian.
The clouds finally cleared, so we have a good air show today. We saw some interesting performances. There was the F-35 and the F-16. Were they part of the highlight of the show for you since you're ex-Air Force?
Well, as an ex-Air Force pilot, fighter pilot, I guess I should say yes, but actually, I was very impressed with the Canadian Snowbirds, and it's the first time I'd seen them in action, and I just thought they were terrific, as I think this show is, by the way. I've been going to air shows for 40 years. That'll tell you how good it is.
Yeah, I was going to say, sorry about the background noise. We just had the demonstration guy from Lucas Oil finish up here.
Right, and we have 500,000 people and probably more here on the beach. But I just want to say that this Huntington Beach Air Show is the best, and having gone to air shows for over 40 years, that's a lot of air shows, and this one is the one that everyone should see.
Yeah, great. Coming up next, I believe, is going to be the Blue Angels. Looking forward to them. The type of flying that the Blue Angels do when you were serving in the Air Force, I'm assuming you did some of the same maneuvers that they did?
Oh, yeah. Well, Air Force, Navy, you know, there's a bit of rivalry there. You know, the Blue Angels are terrific. The Thunderbirds are even more so. But then I'm opinionated.
Yeah, and the Thunderbirds were here last year. So I guess they're giving each branch of service once this year, once next year.
Yeah, and I might suggest something if anyone listening has any ability to do the program here. My wife said she'd like to see a V-stall, some vertical stuff out there. I know the Marines are right there, so hopefully next year we see a little Marine action.
Oh, and get the Osprey to do a little dance here?
Be very nice. Very nice.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, well, Ray, thank you so much for being on the show. Also, thank you so much for your service. I don't know, maybe I'll see you again here next year when they do the show at Huntington Beach.
Anytime, Brian. Thank you very much.
All right. Sounds like a great time was had by all, Brian.
It was. It was fun hanging out with Ray and talking airplanes. And he told a bunch of stories about his fighter days in Vietnam. And it's just fun being around aviation people looking at planes.
All right. We have a airline story of the week. What do you have for us this time?
I think that Air India is doing something really neat here, and I just wanted to focus on them for a bit. And they have the world's youngest female commander of a 777. And they did a bit of celebration with her, making it through the ranks and taking command of a 777. And I think this ties in nicely with the story that we did a while ago about Air India doing the all-female crew.
Right. Yeah. I remember
up
that.
In the flight deck, in the back, the ground staff. So I just think I wanted to highlight the fact that Air India was doing something different here, something special, and really showing how women are making such a positive contribution to aviation.
That's great. Yeah. She's 30 years old, I think, or was 30 when she took command of the 777.
Yeah, when she took command, yes.
Yeah, very cool. So we'll have a link to that article in the show notes. That's from traveler.com.
Do you got 30 seconds for a what's up with Max?
Yeah, and how about a what's up with David?
Well,
yeah, put something in the show plan,
there's
guys.
There's nothing. Well, there is now. Did you just add this in? Okay. Max T, what's up with you?
So just going forward, should we always make sure there's something in? Otherwise, you'll skip us. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, if there's nothing there, I'm going to keep going.
Okay, good. Good to know. I didn't know.
As I see David now getting ready to type his...
No, I'm not going to type nothing. That's fine. I have a whole show to myself on Thursdays. It's fine.
All right. Max T, what's up with you?
Oh, it's been a tiny aviation week for me. I just got back from 3 different days of flying the little RC planes, and I can say I'm getting better, which is nice. It's so much harder, I think, than flying a real airplane. But to continue the tiny airplane theme, I'm headed down to the Harris Ranch this week with one of my clients, which is a well-known restaurant and large cattle ranch in Central California. Not only do they have great steaks and about literally 30,000 head of cattle, but their runway is probably one of the more challenging ones in the country. It's only 30 feet wide, which is less than the width of the airplane that will be going down there.
David, nothing up with you, huh?
What I will say is this. If you want to hear some very interesting ways Canada is handling drone regulation, listen to our latest episode of UAV Digest. If you think the FAA is got issues, you should hear how draconian Canada's become for both commercial and individual pilots, like registration for everybody, mandatory insurance, and compliance on the type of drone. If you have a certain type of drone, after regulations come, you will not be able to fly it in metropolitan areas because it will not meet the minimum standards for Canada. So I would recommend, if you want to hear how progressive the FAA is and how regressive the Canadian Transport Ministry is, listen to that episode.
Right. That's over at the UAVDigest.com. All right. Let's go on to some listener mail. We heard from Anurag. He has been playing with something called Power BI, Business Intelligence. And we'll have a link in the show notes. This is Accidents and Fatalities Trends. And this Power BI, I think this is some software that allows you to, I guess, import a lot of data, and then you can view it in many different ways. And it's kind of an interesting capability. He also posted an article in LinkedIn. It's called Visualizing a Century of Aircraft Accidents with Power BI. And it kind of describes how this works. So we'll put both of those links in the show notes. If you're a data dink and like to push around the numbers, take some different views, this might be kind of interesting. And he's looking for some feedback. So, you know, if you have any, pass it along to us. We'll pass it along to him.
Yeah, Max, I think this stuff's great. I just wonder how much is not being reported, therefore it might skew the numbers.
I can't tell you that, that's for sure.
But it is really cool.
It is cool. Also, Mike sent in, he had heard back from his Congresswoman, Nikki Tsongas, and concerning his communication to her about air traffic control privatization. And her response is interesting and good. She says, I have many concerns with this legislation and do not support privatization of the FAA's air traffic control operations. This proposal could indefinitely delay implementation of the next-gen air traffic control modernization program, cede authority of public resources to a private unaccountable corporation, and could hurt airport access in small communities. And then she has some other thoughts as well. So that's an interesting one. Some of these responses are kind of illuminating. Chris sent in the response from his senator in Alaska, Dan Sullivan, who said, "I do not believe this proposal maintains the current level of aviation safety required in our national airspace. Transferring these safety systems and assets outside of the oversight of Congress and away from the public interest protections of the federal government is not in the best interest of safety." Thanks, Chris, for sending that in. And then we got a great email from Joe. He writes in and says, "I enjoyed your recent guest and story on flying hurricane aid. So I thought there might be interest in other ways your GA pilot listeners use their aircraft." He says, "I built my van's RV-7A over a period of 4.5 years. And then this past summer, I flew to all 48 contiguous states in the span of a 2-week vacation. I think that's that's quite an achievement. What do you think, Max T?
Yeah, no question. And did you happen to notice where he was from? Rough and Ready, California, which I always thought that was a great name. That's a small town up by Sacramento. I'm guessing, and I don't know, I'm guessing it may have been Gold Rush country and gotten the name from those times.
Oh, that's a real town, huh?
Oh, it is. Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, I thought he was being sort of, you know, California-ish.
Yeah, it's about 1,000 people. Oh. It's in the foothills there.
Interesting. So we have a link to the story in a local newspaper, and he's also has a number of blog posts on his blog about this adventure. So we'll put those links in the show notes too. Very cool. Check that out. And then Jim wrote to say he had a short follow-up to Brian's comments on episode 471. And this was concerning the shoulder harness that Brian talked about. Remember that, Brian?
Yeah, I do. Something that I didn't know about the shoulder seatbelt thing. So, again, we have great listeners that definitely educate us as much as we keep them informed.
Jim said the reason his first class seat on United having a shoulder harness has nothing to do with spacing, but instead because, and this is interesting, the angle of the seat. He says certification requirements demand that cabin seating that is angled in excess of certain degrees from forward movement, think G-force, include the shoulder harness to protect the occupant. As a result, there's a growing number of such premium seat products on the market today that contain the shoulder harnesses. So thanks, Jim, for sending that in. And then Randy has been paying attention to Elon Musk, specifically his presentation at the 2017 International Astronautic Congress. And at that event, Elon Musk talked about something that had previously been called the Interplanetary Transport System, or ITS, but it's been nicknamed BFR. Randy writes, "This is Musk's vision for transporting colonists to Mars or any other solid planet or moon in the solar system." But at the end, and this is the interesting part specifically, at the end he showed this video of the surprise application, suborbital flight to nearly anywhere in the world in about 40 minutes. That's right. Elon's thinking that we're going to have these rockets on barges, and they're going to take off and fly you across the planet in 30 or 40 minutes. So there's a video that describes this, and I want to thank Randy for sending that in. There's also an article on The Verge that talks about this. So, I don't know. We talk about lots of different kinds of air travel, including jetpacks this episode. But what do you think, Rob, about getting on a rocket and flying to Asia in half an hour? Is that something you'd ever consider?
Oh, yeah, I'd do it. I mean, if I'd had the opportunity as a journalist, I mean, I would have jumped on the shuttle in a heartbeat. I think it would have been really cool.
How about you, David? Would you go for that?
Only if it was unmanned.
Only if it was unmanned.
Oh, yeah. Good answer.
So that means it would have to be an all-female crew.
Oh, no. Right. How about you, Brian? I'm sure you'd go for this.
Yeah, absolutely, I would. However, it would really cut down on the in-flight experience. So
you wouldn't have time to do anything. Yeah.
Are you kidding? Suborbital means you'd be at zero. You'd be at micro G.
Yeah, yeah. That'd be fun looking out the window, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. Yeah, wow.
I was going to say, yeah, screw the in-flight entertainment. That's a watch out the window.
It sure is.
Kind of flight.
Max, what do you think? Are you up for this?
I think I figured out where the airlines would be going with this if they had that kind of equipment. Since it's going to be suborbital, it's going to be 30 minutes. It's going to be like a subway in New York at rush hour. I'll be strap hangers standing up on that flight the whole way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would make Michael O'Leary really happy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has enough problems right now.
Yeah, I think so.
His employees are revolting.
Yeah.
That's not a nice thing to say about them.
Max, would you go? Max East?
Yes. Especially at this age. If I was like 40 or something, I don't know. I'm not so sure. But, you know, there's not too much left. So I think, if it didn't work out okay, it'd still be a fun way to go. All right. Well, with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Paco Ubereta, for joining us talking about the Martin Aircraft Jetpack. You can find out more about that at martinjetpack.com. You can find out everything you'd ever want to know about us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode you can get to straight away by visiting airplanegeeks.com/472. Let's see. Rob Mark, tell us where we can find you online.
Well, any place that has Jetwine in the name, any place that has Flying Magazine in the name. Hey, next week, if you're in Vegas, at the NBAA show.
Great. Okay. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on whatjustflewby.com or whatjustflewby.photography on Instagram. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAVDigest.com.
And Brian, how do we reach you?
Best place to get a hold of me is to send an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com. And although I haven't logged in yet, I finally got a Slack account. So Yay. Maybe I'll see people in Slack.
Yeah. Boy, we're having some great stuff. Great conversations going on there. Max T. Max Trescott. Where do we find you online?
Well, on Thursday, you'll find me at the Harris Ranch having lunch. But any other time, you can look for me on the aviationnewstalk.com podcast.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, the UAVDigest.com, and PaxXPodcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outros by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.